Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association.
This is episode 74 of Text Messages, a conversation with Walter Dean Myers. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. If there is anyone in the world of children's and young adult literature who could be described as a living legend, it's Walter Dean Myers. Best known for his street-smart works of contemporary realistic fiction, Myers has also written historical fiction, biography, memoir, short story collections, and novels in verse. Over the course of a 45-year career, he has published more than 100 books and won just about every award given to authors who write for young people. Consider his list of honors: 5 Coretta Scott King Awards, 2 Newbery Honor Awards, the first ever Michael L. Prince Award for Excellence in Young Adult Literature, a 3-time finalist for the National Book Award, Lifetime Achievement Awards from the American Library Association, and from ALLEN, the Assembly on Literature for Adolescents of NCTE. Most recently, he completed a 2-year term as National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. No other children's or young adult author has ever been so celebrated. Myers is one of those rare individuals whose books offer both literary merit and widespread teen appeal. Across his body of work, young people will encounter references to classic literature, as well as American history, politics, and philosophy, always in stories that present a complex look at the lives of African Americans. Whether he's writing about contemporary teens growing up in Harlem, or historical figures like Muhammad Ali, Myers challenges readers to grapple with questions about moral decision-making and personal responsibility. At the same time, he writes honestly about the world we live in. While his characters often struggle with racism, poverty, and the stresses of the inner city, Myers refuses to portray them as victims. Instead, he explores their thought processes and exposes their flaws. In doing so, he respects and dignifies his characters and his readers. I had the privilege of interviewing Walter Dean Myers at the 2013 NCTE Annual Convention in Boston. In this episode, I'll bring you highlights from our conversation. You'll hear about his life as a reader and an author, how his own experiences with books have shaped his approach to storytelling, and what he seeks to offer young people through his writing. He'll also talk about the thinking behind a select handful of his novels, books that incorporate concepts as varied as magical realism, the social contract, and oral histories with our nation's war veterans. I began our interview by asking Myers to talk about his role as National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Because the position was created to raise awareness of the importance of lifelong literacy, and because Myers has spoken candidly over the years about whose literacy needs we are meeting in this society and whose we aren't, I wanted to know how he developed his message about the value of reading, particularly for kids who typically don't read.
Well, first, when they asked me to be national ambassador, that sounded really sort of good. National ambassador, by all means. For years I've been talking about literacy, about everyone reading. So now they were saying to me, so if you believe that, now put your money where your mouth is. Go there and represent the Library of Congress and the Every Child a Reader Foundation, and be a representative. And convince people that they should be reading books and they should be reading. My motto was reading is not optional. This idea that reading can take you to faraway places, that's all nice and good. But in today's world, reading is not an option. Either you read well or you suffer. And this is what I've been trying to transmit to the people across the country. If you read well, or you're going to suffer. When you offer a book to a child as an adventure, as a way of escaping, so to speak, many kids who are reluctant readers will say, I'm not interested in escaping. I'm not interested in going to faraway places. This is like opera. You know, I mean, opera is nice. I mean, it's cool if you're into opera, but this is not for me. And what I'm saying that it is for you, and you have to learn how to read, and you have to be a literate person in this world.
Myers has dedicated his career to writing for those very kids, kids who think that reading is not for them. His mission is personal. I knew from reading his essays and memoirs that Myers was a reader from an early age, but he had his own moments of alienation from books. One of his most well-known quotes is that he writes for the troubled boy he once was and the boy who lives inside him still. That quote led me to ask him how he thinks about his audience and what he intends for his books to do for young readers.
Well, I had a conversation with James Baldwin. I only met him once, but you know, I was very thrilled to meet him. Wow. And what I said to him was that growing up, I found books. I found books, and that was my lifesaver. You know, books saved my life. But I never found myself in the books. No, I never found myself in the books. And Baldwin said to me, well, you know, he had the same experience. And he was raised about a half a mile from me in Harlem. So, and I was so thrilled Baldwin had the same experience I had. Oh, so thrilled. But then on the way home, I thought to myself, oh my God, if I had only known that when I was 14. If I had known that there was someone out there who had found books, but who did not find themselves in books, and thereby devalued himself, as I devalued myself. I devalued myself. I didn't want to be black anymore. You know, that didn't seem to be working out very well. You know, and being black did not mean, not wanting to be black, did not mean that I did not appreciate Ralph Bunche in those days, or Thurgood Marshall. You know, these people were so far from me. But I looked around me in my immediate neighborhood, as kids look around them, around their neighborhoods today. Obama is not a black person to them. He's someplace over here. You know, they look at the family and say, this is what I'm going to become. And do I want to become that? Is there any value in that? And I, as an author, I have to say, yes, there is value in your community, in your family, in your life. No matter how difficult it is, there is value. And this is what I need to put into the books, because this is what I needed growing up. And when I get letters from kids, and they'll say things like, oh, I love this book because the two characters were such good friends. And I'm saying, okay, fine. You love this book because you read the book. There were people in the book like you. There were people in the book that reflected your life, and they were human beings.
In an opinion piece about the lack of diversity in young adult literature that was published this past spring in the New York Times, Myers spoke at length about the damage that gets done when young people don't see themselves represented in books. Therefore, the goal of humanizing his characters is at the core of everything he writes. He says he wants his books to humanize poor inner-city kids in the eyes of others and in their own eyes. At the same time, he intends to challenge those kids to reflect on their choices and their moral decision-making, especially when their decisions put them on the wrong side of the law. That's exactly what happens in his novel Dopesick. when the book begins, main character Lil Jay is hiding in an abandoned building. He's been dealing drugs, and he's terrified because he's just shot a cop. Then, in a twist of magical realism, he begins to watch scenes from his life playing out on a television screen. Scenes that force him to confront what he's done and where he went wrong. I asked Myers to talk about how he went about humanizing Lil Jay.
One thing that I see that kids do is disconnect from society. They completely disconnect, and that disconnecting is a coping mechanism. And the mind works with you to cope with your circumstances. The mind. So if you are stealing, the mind says, "That's okay. No, it's okay for you to steal." If you are using drugs, the mind says to you, "Well, nothing you can do, so it's okay." And for me to come and say to a child, a young person, or an adult, and say, "No, this is not okay," no, and you have to give up your coping mechanisms, no, which have worked for you for so many years. Your coping mechanism has been so good to you, has been so faithful to you. You know, now it's time for you to give them up. How do you do this? Well, in fiction, I think you can do it with this magic realism. You know, you say, "All right, no matter what you are saying, this television screen is going to show the truth. It's going to show the truth. You put that on, and that's going to be the truth." And now, you know, after a while, you can't deny that. And so now you have to deal with it. You know, the most difficult thing that, you know, if you meet a young person, the most difficult thing to do with that child is to have that child give up his coping mechanisms. You know. He says, "Well, I'm nothing, so therefore nobody cares about me, so I'll do what I want to do. I'll do this, I'll do the other thing. It doesn't make any difference." You know, or, "I'm going to be in the NBA, even though he's like 5'1". You know, I'll be in the NBA. "You don't know." Yeah. "Yes, I do." No. "Or, I'm going to be a rap artist." This is a coping mechanism. Now, how do you bring the reality to that? The kid doesn't want reality. He doesn't want reality. In Dope Sick, now, this kid may not have wanted reality, but all of a sudden, he's facing it. And that idea just grabbed me.
One of the things I love about Myers' work are the intellectual ideas he offers his readers in the context of street smart realistic fiction. In one of his more recent novels, All the Right Stuff, his goals are similar as in Dope Sick, to confront his characters and his readers with reality. In this book, though, the device he uses is an older character's knowledge of political philosophy. Myers is writing here about the social contract. In doing so, he offers young people another lens for thinking about their own moral choices. I asked Myers to talk about All the Right Stuff and how it, too, helps readers confront the truth about things.
You know, who was it? John Rawlings did a book, Justice is Fairness, I think it was called. And this is how kids think of life as being fair. Life is fair, and I want everything in my life to be fair. And yeah, no, it's not necessarily fair. There are rules. You know, society has there is a social contract, and you know, sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense, but there is a social contract. The story I used to use was, if a person buys a refrigerator and it pays $301 for this refrigerator, and he brings it home and it doesn't work, right? And he takes it back. The guy says, well, you know, buyer beware. Well, the guy says, well, wait a minute. My limit on being ripped off is $300, and this costs $301. So I want my dollar back. Says, not give me anything back. So he takes out his knife, says, give me the dollar back or I'll cut you. And the guy gives him back the dollar. Then he gets arrested. So one guy, our social contract says that I can rip you off at $300 if I use my superior guile. But the social contract also says you cannot take your dollar back using your superior knife. You think that this doesn't affect kids, but when you go to the jails, you see kids who are in jail thinking that they did nothing wrong at the time that they were arrested. What did I do wrong? You know, I did not do anything wrong. They had this slippery slope, you know, and there's this unwritten kind of thing within selling drugs is no big deal. You know, it's no big deal. You know, I mean, if you need money, you sell a little thing. It's okay. It's okay. It's really okay to steal if, okay, I know the cops don't like it, but, you know, it's really okay within the community. No, it's not okay even within the community because it's a social contract that engulfs your community whether you know it or not. No. And so when you begin discussing behavior, and you know the amount of young people, I think the one stat said as many as 40% of all people, black males between the ages of 18 and 25, have been in jail. It's an alarming figure. When you start talking about behavior, you have to start talking about the social contract. You know, what's acceptable in our society and what's not. And many kids just don't understand it. They don't know why it exists. And it's arbitrary. It's arbitrary in many cases. Our country is built on, our constitution is built on some very arbitrary rules. You know, some of the battles we are facing today, you know, who can you marry, and all these kinds of things. These are arbitrary rules, you know, that we have, but they're there. And so, and I thought that by beginning with that, then you can go on to rules which deal with morality, but you need to start someplace, and a good place to start would be the social contract.
Beyond literary knowledge and philosophical knowledge, another portion of Walter Dean Meyer's work offers readers historical knowledge. Three of his novels focus on war and show how military service often connects family members across generations. In the first, Fallen Angels, main character Richard Perry is on a tour of duty in Vietnam. In the second, Sunrise Over Fallujah, the main character is Robin Perry. He's Richie's nephew, and he's serving in the war in Iraq. One of Meyer's most recent books, Invasion, completes the arc by skipping back to World War II and a secondary character named Marcus Perry, who is father and uncle to the other two. I asked Meyer to talk about how his war novels complement the rest of the work he's doing for young readers. His answer focused less on his purpose than on the ways these wars touched his own family.
I dropped out of school at 16. I dropped out of school at 15. I got caught, put back in school, dropped out at 16. And then I joined the Army on my 17th birthday, right? And I went into the Army, and I was trying to make much of that. I came home with a few bullets in my pocket, showing off my brothers. And my brother joined. And he went. The war was picking up. The Vietnam War,
yeah.
And it was picking up. And he was sent to Vietnam. He was killed the very first day. That was devastating to me, you know. And so I know I had entered the Army with sort of a purposefully romanticized ideas. We can romanticize ideas purposefully. We say, oh, this is a wonderful thing. Yeah, right. So I wrote some short stories trying to figure out what I was thinking about my brother's death. There was a sadness, but there was guilt involved, you know, and what was I doing when he was being killed in that moment, you know. And so I did that book, and that was array of me trying to work my way through. When my son went into the military, he went to Iraq. I said, oh my God, you know. And I almost wrote that book as an amulet. You know, I said, maybe if I'm writing about it, nothing's going to happen to him. It sounds really kind of scared, spooky, but I really thought that way. And so, and I wanted to understand what was going on in his mind. He was coming home, he was telling me stuff about the trauma that these soldiers, young soldiers, soldiers who would have been killed in Vietnam, not being killed in Iraq, but the trauma that they were facing is devastating, and it's going to be with us for decades.
Myers went on to say that his connection to World War II was less personal and direct, but once again, writing about war involves sorting through what he could glean from the experiences of real-life veterans, ones who ultimately needed him in order to get their stories told.
Then the idea came to, I was approached by the publisher and says, why don't you do World War II? And I said, well, you know, I wasn't that interested in doing World War II. But I had spoken to a lot of people about their involvement in World War II. You know, many of them were dying. They were dying every day. You know, you hope he answers the phone, you know. And they began telling me, and you know what happens if you ask people about their experiences? They want to tell someone. And they want to tell someone who will understand. And they don't have the language. They don't have the words to say that I went in as a civilian and who believed in the social contract, who believed in Christianity, and then I learned to kill people, and I learned to walk away from my friends who were dead, and I learned to see my friend being killed and say, oh my God, I'm glad it wasn't me. You know, they become different people, and they don't have the words to express that. They don't have the language. So if they think they can trust you, they will pour out the stories to you. They will pour out the stories. So I had some stories. I asked a few people. I do interviews in three steps. Now, the first step, I'm introducing myself. You know, tell me about your story. No, can I call you back? No, I say 15 minutes and 20 minutes. Can I call you back? And I let them. You know, I say yes, and I make up time to call them back. And so now they're thinking about the story, and they're thinking that, oh, this guy seemed like a pretty nice guy, and they'll amplify it. And then, you know, I'll go over the questions I want to ask with my wife, and I'll say, you know, like my wife asked me, when did a guy sleep? You know, when did he get his first good night's sleep? And I call him back and I ask him about that, and he began to cry. You don't want to make a 90-year-old man cry. No. And the guy began to cry. He says, I couldn't sleep for months. No, I just had this cat naps for months. You know, even when I came home, I couldn't sleep. You know, and they want their stories told, and they don't have the language, and then they see that you do, they are thrilled. They're thrilled. And you're not going to embarrass them. You're not going to disgrace them. And you're going to tell their stories. And it's just, the day I came down here, a Friday morning, the black guy who plays a really a peripheral role in the book called me. He know, the guy I based it on, he called me. And he said, I got the book, and I'm so thrilled, and I'm so happy that you wrote this book. You know, because he went through a major trauma in his life, a psychological trauma that he doesn't know how to deal with. And it's almost like dealing with a divorce. You know, how do you deal with that? How do you face that? All those emotional issues. And so they want to tell me the stories. And I'm known in the black community as a storytelling man. So, you know, people would come to me with stories and documents, and it's stunning.
I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Research support for this show was provided by Betty Gibson at St. Louis University. Next month, I'll be back to bring you a show featuring what I'll call forgotten YA. That is, titles published 10 or more years ago that give us a sense of where the field was before its current boom in popularity. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller.
More episodes of Text Messages are available at readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening, and look forward to more text messages soon.